From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in August 2014 in a Wegmans parking lot. Our IT research professor Roger Duby and his wife noticed a group of people wearing Tesla jackets. They had apparently been invited by Danny Wegman to demo a Tesla in the parking lot. Now, Roger wanted to learn more, spent about an hour reading about Elon Musk's big project, and Roger was hooked. Several months later, he purchased his own Model S. Roger had a charger installed in his garage. Each full charge gives him roughly 300 miles. But if this is the future, well, so far, it's not cheap. We don't know what Roger paid for his car, but the list price of this model is around $72,000. And in the future, will prices come down, or will new technologies like a self-driving feature make it even more expensive? Well, Musk said last week that Autopilot, the company's self-driving car program, can reduce the risk of car accidents by 50%. That is a big claim. Musk is saying that right now we're already seeing technology that is much safer than simply allowing humans to drive their own cars. This hour, we look at the future of electric vehicles and car navigation systems. It's our monthly science roundtable. Let me welcome my guests. Roger Duby's here, the man with the car, who happens to have given a ride to our producer, Megan Mack, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. Roger, nice to see you here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also here is Jeff Botticello. He's a third-year mechanical engineering student at RIT and the team manager for RIT's electric vehicle team. Jeff, what's the shorthand for the team?
EVT.
Rev 1's the vehicle?
Rev 1 is our vehicle, yeah.
All right, so the EVT and Rev 1 is
correct.
The vehicle. Well,
yeah.
Welcome. Thanks for being here. And Derek Goodheil's here. Derek's a fifth-year mechanical and computer engineering student at RIT, also a member of RIT's EVT, the electric vehicle team. Derek, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, before we talk the future of navigation systems, automobiles, etc., let me welcome Randy Gorman, news director from WXXI, who came from down the hall to mention that it is a big and important week for our station.
It is fundraising week, and actually I told Roger off the air, I'd like to borrow his Tesla as a new news car, but your donations will not pay for Tesla, as much as I wish they would.
That would be profligate at this point.
It would be, but we do need money for just shows like this. We do have, obviously, brought Evan over here a few years ago, does an incredible job with Connections. We've got his producer, Megan Mack, all the folks, Juan Vasquez, who was experimenting with Facebook Live last hour. There's technology, there's staff. We need your help. You can make a donation. Any amount is welcome. 454-6300. That's 454-6300. Or you can just do it online at your convenience, wxxi.org/give. That's wxxi.org/give. And again, to keep this kind of programming going, it costs money to not just put on the lights, but hire the people, get the new technology. We appreciate it. We'll be doing that this week, asking you occasionally for this. Try not to interrupt too much programming. I know you've got a great show, Evan. And again, to keep it going, we need that help right now.
Well, thank you, Randy. Again, what's the number? I'm sorry.
It is 454-6300.
All right. I'd love right now, if you're a listener to Connections and you're a regular listener and you've never made a pledge, that would be a wonderful thing to call right now. Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Let's talk about what is going on this hour. It's our monthly science roundtable. Roger Duby, tell me about that day in the Wegmans parking lot. I mean, had you heard of Tesla before?
I certainly had heard of Tesla.
Sure, of course.
I was surprised to see these folks there with Tesla jackets, and so I immediately realized, oh my God, they must be here. And so my wife and I were getting coffee, and after we had that, I said, we have to find them in the parking lot. So we sort of did this raster scan and found the car, and as you said earlier, I was there for an hour, asking questions, looking at things, et cetera.
Okay, well, let me grab Megan Mack, our producer, because Megan has now ridden in Roger's Tesla. I have not. You got the good assignment. Is that fair?
That's very fair. I had a great time in the Tesla. I recommend it to anyone.
When did you get out there, Ms. Mack?
Oh, it was a couple weeks ago. It was a bright, sunny day, and I know the weather was key because we had been planning this, I think, last month, Roger, and It was rainy, it was a little overcast, and we wanted to make sure it was the best experience possible. So we had a wonderful day weather-wise, and we went out on the road near RIT. And it was a lot of fun.
Well, one of the things that Megan and I are trying to do going forward on this program is a little bit more in-the-field reporting connected to this program. And so Megan had a chance, as we said, to go out with Roger. And what are we going to hear here, Ms. Mack?
You are going to hear the full test drive that Roger gave me, along with some information about the technology behind the car, because I wanted to experience Tesla itself, but also understand what makes the car so special.
Roger Duby says he never planned to buy a Tesla, but after seeing the car on display and experiencing a test drive, the RIT professor says he couldn't resist.
It was a complete accident and totally unplanned. We were at Wegmans, and this group of three young people walked by with Tesla jackets on. And I said, Tesla's here, Tesla's here. So then we did this raster scan of the parking lot till we found the Tesla. I spent like an hour with them.
After several months of research, Doobie purchased a Tesla Model S. The company describes the car as the safest, most exhilarating sedan on the road. It can accelerate from 0 to 60 miles per hour in just under 3 seconds, and it comes with autopilot capabilities.
This is really a computer on wheels, and that's why I fell in love with it. I was immediately enthralled.
And so was I. I took a ride in the Tesla to experience the acceleration and the car's other features firsthand. At full disclosure, I am not a car enthusiast, but I have to admit, the Tesla is cool.
You can hear the engine roaring away. The original car just had one motor on the rear wheels. This one is a dual motor. Since there's no engine, there's just a motor which resides literally on the axle. The space that would normally be consumed by an engine is empty, so they make that available to you as a trunk. But since it's in the front, it's the front trunk, which is called the frunk. I don't know what they call them in England.
A foot?
Maybe a boot and a foot.
All kidding aside, the technology in the car is impressive. It has two computers and a set of firmware. You may not think about the computers when you're a passenger, but you do notice the 17-inch touchscreen display between the two front seats. The car has a 3G connection, so you can check your email, do some Googling, or even search for Tesla charging stations while you're driving. Then there's the car's sensors, which monitor traffic and calculate the speed of nearby vehicles.
As we pass vehicles or as they pass me, I see things pop up on the 3D display that says there's something over here on the side. And of course, it has, you know, rear view sensors as well. There is what's called LiDAR, which is sort of like radar, except using light. So it has the ability to sort of ping to see how far objects are. So it will tell me how far I am from this stop sign, for example.
But what about the acceleration? Is it as impressive as it sounds? I was about to find out.
Ready?
Ready, yep. Oh my God.
60.
That is so cool.
The thing that I find amazing is that it's got a flat acceleration curve, so it starts accelerating immediately at its top acceleration capability at 0 miles an hour, and it continues at that acceleration speed up to 120, which is where they have it sort of capped.
Then there's the autopilot feature. Doobie says it wasn't installed in his car when he first purchased it because it was still going through the debugging stage at Tesla. But since he purchased the tech package, he can install software updates from Tesla whenever they are available.
You wake up and it's almost like Christmas. Suddenly you have new capability in the car that you didn't have yesterday. Well, I've got it in autopilot now and it saw the car in front of me coming to a virtual halt. So it really slowed down. So I'm not driving. It's doing the driving for me. It watches all of the other cars around you. It's continually doing calculations to see whether or not it decides that you're perhaps not paying attention to the car in front of you. And so it'll go ahead and slow down or slam on the brakes depending on how inattentive you are. And it will make this really obnoxious ding to let you know that you are really supposed to be paying attention here.
As for charging the car, Doobie has a charger installed in his garage, and there's a network of Tesla charging stations across the country. A full charge equates to about 300 miles. Tesla CEO Elon Musk says the car can be a lifesaver, and that the autopilot feature reduces the risk of accidents by about 50%. I asked Doobie if he feels safer in a Tesla than in a car without enhanced technology.
Significantly safer. I've felt it avoid other cars that were wandering out of their lane. This car will just move out of the way, and it will ding to let me know that, you know, something's a little erratic right now, and it wants me to be aware, so it tries to get my attention.
But does having that cushion of knowing the car is taking care of you lead Tesla drivers to be less alert behind the wheel, either consciously or subconsciously?
I think that it allows you to not have to basically apply all of the energy to that concentration and to being alert and making sure that your reaction times are up.
And what about the cost? Doobie says over a 10-year period, the cost of ownership of a Tesla is less than the cost of owning a high-end car like a BMW or a Mercedes. The list price for a Tesla is about $72,000. But Doobie says it's worth it.
Not only is it ecologically clean, it's quiet, it's intelligent and takes care of you and does all of these things, but it's also very, very cost-effective. It's just so much fun to drive.
All right, so there's Megan Mack riding with Roger. Roger had this big smile the entire time the piece is playing. You loved seeing some of her reactions, didn't you?
Absolutely. I knew it was going to happen, but they never expect it until all of a sudden they're pushed back against their seat for 3 seconds, and boom, we're at 60. It's just a remarkable experience.
Megan, did that scare you? Well, you used the word cool.
It was cool. I was surprised. I wasn't afraid, but I was surprised. It reminded me a little bit of the Rock and Roller Coaster at Disney World, where it just shoots right off. That was exactly what happened in the car.
Roger's got a car that can actually fly to the moon, but he doesn't have a cell phone that can be put on vibrate. It's an amazing thing here.
See, technology.
You got to get called out for that.
Yes.
All right, so Megan, you mentioned a couple things there, and your conversation with Roger toward the end there already got some feedback from our audience about concentration. One of our avid listeners, especially in the science programs, is Jake, and he said, did your producer seriously just say check your email while driving? But, you know, he said it kind of cheekily. But Megan, what do you think about that?
I think, well, the last question I asked Roger was, do people get too comfortable because they know the car is taking care of them? And as we were in autopilot mode going down a straightaway, Roger didn't have any hands or feet on the car at all. It was controlling it. And he was showing me different charging stations on the computer throughout the country. So, you know, I hate to say it, but I can see people getting too comfortable and not paying attention because they feel this cushion of the car and the self-driving mode.
Well, I'm glad you got the assignment. That was fun.
Thank you.
That's producer Megan Mack. Now, Roger Duby, how about that point there?
Mm-hmm.
You think it makes you safer, but what about that possible distraction?
Yeah, and I agree. That possible distraction's there. At first, I was certainly drawn to it. As time has gone on, I sort of prefer to leave the task of looking at the internet news or email and things like that to my wife, who's sitting next to me. She can deal with that because it pulls my eyes away from the road too much. And so I don't do that. It crosses a point where I'm no longer comfortable doing that. At first, it was intriguing, but yeah. I've since backed off.
Jeff and Derek, do you trust human beings, especially people closer to your age, to be as responsible as Roger and say, I've got this autopilot feature, but I'm just going to make sure that I'm still engaged and I'm not on technology?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who are responsible, but they're certainly the ones who would just look at email the whole time, not pay attention to the road.
That's my concern too. What do you think, Derek?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. There's always going to be people that are distracted, but the more driving the car does for you, the less necessary it is to be totally focused.
Well, it's true. And Roger, you told Megan that, you know, it dings. It lets you know when people are sort of veering your way, that there was enough that made you feel that it is making you safer, even mm-hmm. with that. So even if people are somewhat distracted, I would hope that this vehicle is going to engage them if there is a danger. What do you think?
Absolutely. It engages you so that you become alert. So it draws your eyes right to the road immediately with this loud ding. It, however, has significantly faster reaction times than I do. The time that it takes me to notice something, make a decision, and then do something with my foot is much longer than the reaction time of the Tesla. And so I've recognized in many cases where the car just slams on the brake because something's flying across in front of the car, where I could not possibly have reacted that quickly.
So it really has happened.
It has happened.
We have listeners who are essentially asking, can you override the autopilot?
Sure,
feature?
Of course. You can take control back at any time. You can take control back partially or fully. If you take the steering wheel and just twist it a little bit, you will overpower the control that it has over the wheel, and now you've got control of the steering wheel, but cruise control is still on. You can also just tap on the brake, and then it'll disengage the entire system, and now you're completely driving.
Listeners, if you've got any questions or comments about this or other related issues for our monthly Science Roundtable, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. By the way, Gizmodo reporting that 50% number that Elon Musk gives, Elon Musk saying that the autopilot feature for the Tesla reduces the risk of car accidents by 50% when a vehicle is using that system rather than a human driver. But Musk didn't really offer details into how they reached the figure. He defines an accident as an incident that caused an airbag deployment. That's a pretty high bar to clear. So my guess is, you know, that's a little bit of a rigged statistic. I mean, I don't want to, rigged is maybe a strong word, but do you buy that number yet, Roger? You want to see more research?
I don't know if there's enough data yet. I would think the number's kind of small. It will take time because you really need to do a sampling of folks that are not using autopilot and the systems that are. And the systems that are have to somehow be engaged in an accident or and the other folks also, so you can do a meaningful comparison to see what the accident rate is. And I would think it's going to take some time to get those statistics high enough. One of the things that perhaps may not be clear to folks is that the Tesla uses deep learning. So each car reports its responses to traffic condition to the cloud, and Tesla's algorithm learns reactions to those conditions and then shares them back with the entire fleet. So the entire fleet of cars learns as time goes on and becomes better, becomes more intelligent, becomes more cautious. So it's really quite remarkable to see how the car has become more conservative as time has gone on in terms of self-driving. I've noticed a significant difference there. And I think the concept of using deep learning like that is clearly a really significant trend for the future. That's a really good way to do things.
To some degree, Roger, I think of self-driving cars and some of the resistance to them in the same way that people might have said, what do I need the internet on my phone for? I've got computers. This is ridiculous. I don't even want this. Now, of course, no one can live without it, right? To some degree, I think we're going into a world with self-driving cars, whether people sort of want it or not. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the same technological path that pilots have followed. Large jets, passenger jets, have autopilot. When the conditions are comfortable, the pilot can engage autopilot and then relax. Obviously, there's a lot less going on up in the sky than there is on a highway. But nonetheless, as time goes on, you learn to trust it more and more because it is so much more conservative than you are.
Larry in Manchester, we're coming to you in just a moment, but hang there for one more second. I want to ask Megan Mack one more question if we could, because, again, our producer had a chance to ride with Roger. And two points on there before we leave the whole self-driving thing, Megan. It sounded to me that you were impressed with the quality of the handling when it was in that autopilot mode, yes?
Absolutely. It was a very smooth ride. I felt very safe. There was one question I had, though, and I asked Roger this. When we got to an intersection, the car stops because it knows that the driver has to take over. But what if there's an issue where the car's confused or there's something in the road? That I was a little unsure about that. What were to happen if there something were to pop up in the road or it didn't realize it was an intersection? You can always switch back to manual mode.
Sure.
But
yeah,
I'm sure there's a moment of panic, possibly, in a situation like that.
Well, Roger, have you had those moments?
Absolutely. So I've been in situations where the car has handed control back to me, and I think it's perfectly appropriate because the intersection had some complicated things going on. I've been passing through intersections in other conditions where the light was green, the cars in front of me were proceeding, the cars on either side were stopped. And my car decided we're good to go. And it just continued through cautiously. It slowed down, went through the intersection, and then sped back up.
And Megan, you said you're not a car enthusiast, but you were impressed with the autopilot system. But is that a feature you want as a driver? Would you be comfortable having that?
I think in certain situations, yes. But overall, I don't think that I'm ready to trust it yet. That's just my personal opinion.
No, thank you, Megan. And here's the reason I asked that, because she had a chance to see it and was probably thought it was better than she even thought it would be, Roger.
Mm-hmm.
And human beings are going to be a hard sell on this because
Sure. Some
people like to drive, first of all. Second of all, we're not very good at driving. We get distracted by a lot of things. We have a lot of accidents and a lot of people die every year. And yet we still feel like, well, we want to be in control. I think you could show all kinds of data that shows these autopilot, these self-driving systems improve safety. But if I own a Tesla or if I own anything, a Google car, which I think crashed, didn't the Google car crash?
Yes, it did.
Okay. So, but no matter what the car, the vehicle that I own is, if it has a self-driving system and there is a crash and I'm injured in some way, you could tell me, well, unfortunately, there's always going to be bugs or errors, but it's still overall safe. You know how fast the attorney industry will grow for, I mean, the injury attorneys are going to explode on this because there will be maybe fewer accidents, but they'll be able to say, hey, you trusted that system. You didn't have control, and now we want Elon Musk's checkbook to open.
That's
it.
Correct. I mean,
you think that's going to happen?
Well, I'm sure if the opportunity occurs, it will happen because clearly Tesla has deep pockets, and so I think it would be an obvious opportunity to try to act on that. So right now, the self-driving feature remains conservative. It gives control back to the driver. It requires that you keep your hand on the wheels at all on the steering wheel at all times. So the early implementations before and the early beta tests, they didn't check for that. Now it'll tell you. It's like, you know, your hand is not on the steering wheel. You need to put your hand back on the steering wheel. The advantage to that is that if the autopilot suddenly does something peculiar, you know, the steering wheel jerks because there's a large truck that's wandering into your lane, you are immediately and tactically aware of what's happening. And so that I think, is a nice little interface, and so it keeps me in touch literally with the car.
All right. Well, then let's pivot on the Tesla and then eventually on the Rev 1 side to the sort of the green features, the electric aspect of this, and that's what Larry in Manchester wants to ask about. So go ahead, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I know you have two separate discussions kind of going on, one about autonomous driving and one kind of about electric cars, I guess. But I'm going to question how green a Tesla actually is. And I don't know the answer to the question, but they call them green. But when I consider green, I consider all the way from the manufacturing process, the footprint that the factory leaves behind, the carbon content, and also where your electricity is made. If you're fueling up the car with electricity, you think it's real clean and everything, but if it's made by coal or some other fossil fuel, we're just kind of kicking the can down the road, so to speak.
Right. Yes.
I'd like to hear my comments off the
sure.
phone, please.
Yeah, you got it. Thank you, Larry. Thanks for the phone call. All right, Roger, why don't you start? Go ahead.
Okay, Larry, a lot of very good points there. Number one, I think the only reasonable measure of green is cradle to grave. You really want to look at the amount of energy it took to make the car. The amount of energy and the source of energy that it takes to run the car for its lifetime and then its disposal. I think all of those factors have to be included to really determine whether or not a car is green. Just to look at the tailpipe and say there are no emissions, I think, is short-sighted. It's not fair. All of that said, one of the points, though, that you raised, which is also valid, is the source of electricity. One of the beauties of electric vehicles is that as the country moves to cleaner and cleaner sources of electricity, we're using more and more wind power, we're using more solar, we're moving away from the old coal-fired plants to things like natural gas, et cetera, the overall source of electric power by itself becomes greener. It introduces fewer nasty hydrocarbons into the atmosphere. And so we are sort of riding on the back of a general move of the electric industry to more and more clean production. And so in a sense, the car is getting cleaner with time because the electricity is getting cleaner with time.
In our second half hour, we're going to learn a lot more about the Rev 1, and we'll kind of tackle that question with our guests. But let me get one more on the Tesla. This is from Jake, and he writes, one of the biggest problems with deployment of electric cars is scale. Even when Tesla's newest Gigafactory is finished and in full production in 4 years, we won't have the production capacity for batteries to do much more than trickle into the market over the next couple decades. As I understand it, they have to limit production right now simply because they would artificially spike battery prices by trying to make as many as they can sell. How wrong am I? And where do we stand going forward with the biggest single component of electric cars, which is the battery?
Right. And I have to confess that I don't know the answer to your question. I think it's a very important and good question. I think all of this is a learning exercise by humanity as we move to a different platform for movement and locomotion. And so these are going to have to be addressed. Clearly, if a lithium ion type of battery has an issue with its fundamental source being constrained or somehow limited, that's going to have to be addressed. However, the fact that it's limited will immediately give impetus to R&D around the world to try to solve the problem. And so I think, like the space program, it's pushing us in a direction that is actually beneficial to lots of other folks inside industries as well.
All right, Jeff and Derek, any thoughts there on batteries and how, you know, sort of the future of that market and how that's impacting either prices or production?
I was just going to say the same thing Roger did. Obviously, the gigafactories, the goal is to double the world's production of batteries or lithium-ion batteries. And like he was saying, as the cars become more popular and the demand increases, that's only going to increase the amount of R&D, only going to increase the desire, you know, for a lot of other people to get in the battery producing game. So hopefully that would, you know, solve that shortcoming.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think certainly over the last 10 years or so, you can see that the price and, like, demand for lithium-ion batteries, the price is going way down and the demand is still going up. Like, 10 years ago, to buy a lead-acid battery pack of the same capacity would have cost multitudes more than what a lithium-ion pack now. So we're definitely heading in the right direction, I would say.
I keep trying to get away from Tesla, but our listeners want more questions. Peter on Facebook. Peter on Facebook says, how does the Tesla negotiate traffic lights?
At this time... So let me just back up quickly to remind folks that with the 3G connection that's alive 24 hours a day, the Tesla fleet, all of the Tesla cars, get software updates pushed into the car whenever Tesla decides that it's necessary. Of course, you know, the owner can say, no, I don't want to install this update. But that aside, the system is continually being updated, and so features in the autopilot are being developed. Traffic lights in particular, the tail lights of cars in front of you, are not yet being folded into the equation of how the car is handling the situation. Right now, it's relying upon the LiDAR, the radar, and the video feed that it's using to sort of sense the environment around the car, and it reacts to that. But it's not yet aware of stop signs and traffic lights.
Sure.
I suspect that'll come.
And Paul writes to the program and says, zero emissions and low energy costs of an electric car are intriguing. However, my PC at home, my cell phone, and anything electronic seems to have at least daily failures. Autopilot mode would require a level of reliability I have not seen in any of today's products.
I understand that. I have software failures.
Yeah.
I think that the quality management issues for the software have to be extremely high because you're putting people on the road in these cars at high speed. You can't really afford to have errors like that occur. You always need to have that interactive presence with the driver so that in the event that there is a something that happens that the software can't handle, it can properly get your attention and give you control back. And I think that's going to continue. It'll hopefully just become a more and more rare event as the software gets more refined.
Well, I hope we've answered as many of your questions as we can. We're due for our only short break of the hour, and we're going to come back and learn a lot more about what RIT has going on, their EVT, the electric vehicle team, the Rev1, and more. So short break, and our monthly Science Roundtable continues in a moment. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. What do Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh, and Cincinnati have in common? They are cities that have urban design centers that Rochester can learn from, and we will explain how as we look at the Reshaping Rochester series. Then in our second hour, the future of food trucks in Rochester. The rodeos are back, but as the city relaxed the regulations that food trucks were hoping would happen, we'll talk about it.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our news director is Randy Gorbman. So, Randy, my first very important question to you is this. Mm-hmm. If NASCAR goes with self-driving cars, does that cheapen the victories?
It would make the crashes more interesting, I think. Yeah, I'm not really sure what would happen. But
gearhead. Do you call yourself a gearhead? You're a gearhead.
To some extent. I grew up in that era when cars were, you know, internal combustion engine.
How did Megan Mack get the assignment and you did not?
And she even invited me to go along and I couldn't. I had a schedule conflict.
She's nodding.
It should have been me instead of her, actually, but that's okay. In any case, it is topics like this that really make this show so fascinating. I mean, we've covered, obviously, on your show, Evan, such a wide range of topics in recent days. We had Tom Golisano recently talking about any number of issues, including his political history and his philanthropy. We also did a lot on the elections, of course, the New York primaries, and this entire year, and that's going to really gear up later in the year, of course, as I know you'll have more of the candidates on and talking about some of the big races we have going on locally. But to do all that, we need your help. This is Pledge Week here at WXXI. Anything you can provide will help us continue programming like this. 454-6300. That's 454-6300 to make a donation. Any amount, of course, is welcome. Or you can do it online, wxxi.org/give. You could do it a sustaining basis, maybe $5-$10 a month if it's easier for you that way. Just whatever you can do today. But really, it's important not just for what you hear on the air, but what goes on behind the scenes, the technology, the staff, the ongoing expenses. But believe me, if you listen to any program like this one today, you know it's really worth it.
I always say, you know, not at all in a threatening way, but just think about if Connections was gone, what would you be willing to pay on an annual basis to get it back? And if you can afford that, we'd love for you to share it with us. 454-6300. Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Are you going to get a ride in the Tesla?
I'm going to go down and take
You're
a look
angling?
At it. I'm angling. I'm trying to be really nice to Roger. We'll see what happens.
He's a very gregarious guy with the Tesla. He loves showing it off there. That's Randy Gorbman, the news director from WXXI. If you're just joining our monthly science roundtable, we're talking about the future of navigation systems, electric vehicles, and more with Roger Duby, research professor at RIT and the owner of a Tesla Model S. And Jeff Botticello and Derek Goodheil are here. They are with RIT's electric vehicle team. And Derek's got a little history at Tesla as well. Is that right, Derek?
Yes, I do. I interned there a few times.
Okay. How did you like it?
Loved it. It was a lot of fun.
Well, what is the history of your partnership? And take us back here. Before I get back to your phone calls, I see the phone ringing again, which is great. I mean, people are really engaged with this. I want to hear a little bit more about the history of RIT's electric vehicle team. Derek, Jeff, set a little bit of the background for us and tell us about some of the missions and what you've been building.
So we're a student organization on RIT's campus that was started about 5 years ago with the intention of racing electric motorcycle at the Isle of Man. So we right currently have a multitude of vehicles. We have electric bicycles, an electric go-kart, and our main project, Rev 1, which is an electric motorcycle that we compete annually with at the New Jersey Motorsports Park in Millville, New Jersey. So what we've done is taken a stock Kawasaki Ninja frame and outfitted it with an electric powertrain. And through that, we've done a lot of engineering, and it's really a big learning experience for all the students involved.
Okay, and how have the results been?
So our first race was this past year in July at New Jersey Motorsports Park, and we were the only collegiate team to successfully race an electric motorcycle, so we effectively won our class.
By default, we won.
Yes.
Yeah.
But how was the actual performance of the vehicle? That's important.
We competed well with production bikes that were there for the first couple laps, but we certainly found problems that we hadn't anticipated, and that's what we've been working on this year, fixing them to try to make it more powerful bike.
All right, so is that ultimately the goal? What's the overall goal for the team?
Really to make the fastest motorcycle we can.
Yeah.
And how fast are we talking? What's possible?
I think we did 110, 115 miles an hour down the back straight on the track. Could probably go a little faster if we had a little more room, but we geared it a little low so that we could navigate all the turns and everything. It's not designed for top speed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you talked about some running into some challenges. What's been the biggest challenge so far?
I think the biggest challenge is that we don't have a lot of data to start with. Mm-hmm. A lot of the challenge with motorcycle or electric vehicle design in general has to do with range, as I know you guys were talking about before. With a race, it's somewhat different because it's not like a city figure, but we just have to finish the race. A lot of it is balancing the weight of the pack with how far we have to go. So at the end of the race, we want the pack to be entirely discharged. We want to have nothing left in the tank. because if we had to put a little more capacity on, that's more weight, and that takes us longer to get around the track. So that's a huge challenge. And a lot of what we've been doing is been trying to set up a software system so that we can collect data on how much battery capacity we use during races.
All right, so you're talking about races. You're talking about having exactly the capacity to get to the finish line and basically no more.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
I want to know, practically going forward, the work that you guys are doing. Because what you're talking about is fun. Mm-hmm. But what's the practical application, do you think, going forward?
I think any vehicle, but specifically an electric vehicle where capacity is so critical to the acceptance of the vehicle, it's balancing, it's that optimization that Jeff was talking about. And in our case, sure, we're doing it for a race, but it's always a balancing act between the amount of energy you can store and how much weight you have to carry around, and how much size it takes up too, right? No one wants to buy a car if it has no cargo room because they stuffed twice as much batteries in it as anybody else. But so just that, it's just an optimization problem and trying to figure out exactly how many batteries you want to carry on board so that you can get a 300-mile range, you know, an acceptable figure, but you don't want to go overboard because you start, it's like diminishing returns. You start adding too much weight to the car.
Agree, Jeff?
I would agree. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, Roger, you want to weigh in on that as well? I mean, go ahead.
No, I agree completely. It's an important trade-off, and I think that at least in the case of cars, the issue really is one of what's the target audience? What type of use are they envisioning for this car? Is it going to be a daily commute? Is it going to be used for trips, for family trips? And those, I think, are two very different cars.
I think people hear about so-called green auto technology, battery-powered electric vehicles, and it feels very modern and recent. And the history goes back a lot longer. You're nodding, Jeff. History, yeah. I guess, goes back a lot longer than we probably realize, yes?
Yeah, I would think so. I was just laughing because when we went to our last race this year, our series is part of this ARMA competition, which is an American Historic Racing Motorcycle Association, and everyone there has gas bikes, and they've been riding them for 30 or 40 years. And then we show up with a few other production electric bikes that are racing, and everyone was gawking over us. Like, what is that? We've never seen that before.
But battery-powered electric vehicles were being made as early as, I guess, the late 1800s, weren't they? Isn't that right?
Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, it's much simpler. An electric motor is much less complicated than a gasoline engine. You know, think about how much is going on in a gas engine. Most people don't understand how a gas engine works because it's so complicated. And there's so many parts and so much, and you got to keep it oiled. You have all this stuff. It's not an easy challenge to create a gasoline engine. And electric motors, while fairly rudimentary back then, were still much more understood, much simpler to produce, much simpler to make. But I think the same problem ultimately bit them that is still the topic for discussion now is range. They just, you know, you couldn't go more than 30, 40 miles, whereas a gas car, you could fill it up and keep going.
The Volt I always heard was around 40 miles. Is that, I don't know if that's changed. Has that changed?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and your Tesla is 300 miles?
Correct.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are we going to see range improve further?
Range right now is governed by the size of the battery. And so the latest versions of the Tesla that are available already have about 10 to 15% more range than I have. It's a larger battery. I mean, the trade-off's very clear. It's no surprise as to how they're doing that.
Okay. Let me grab some more listener feedback here. Ken in Palmyra is next. Go ahead, Ken.
Hi, yes, I got a question about with electric cars. What do you do for a heater and defroster?
Okay, good question.
Thanks, Ken.
The electric cars use the electric technology for heating and cooling. So for the Tesla, for example, it's very important to keep the battery pack operating within a friendly range of temperatures. And so Tesla has developed a very advanced liquid coolant system that continually, whenever it needs it, in the middle of the night at 20 degrees below zero in your garage, the car will quietly turn itself on. Remember, there's no motor, so there's really no sound, but it will turn itself on and it will flow the propellant through the coolant through the battery and warm it back up. It uses an electric heater of sorts to do that. And that same type of system is used for cooling the passenger compartment using something sort of like a Peltier device, which is something, a thermoelectric cooler where you can apply a voltage to the device and one plate gets very hot and the other side gets very cold. It just sort of pulls the two temperature extremes apart. That type of technology can be applied in the car as well.
I think it's important to note, too, assuming you were referring to passenger compartment heating and cooling, like winters in Rochester is a great example. You have to wait for the car to warm up before you can get the defrost going. And that's because the whole engine has to get warm because the heater is running off coolant from the motor. Whereas a Tesla, it's like an electric space heater. You know, you turn it on, there's hot air coming out. So it's neat in that aspect, and it's I don't know, it's kind of a breath of fresh air. Instead of sitting in your car, waiting for it to warm up, waiting for the heat to go and shivering, you get in and turn it on, and the heat is immediately hot. And similarly with the air conditioning, it doesn't need the motor to be spinning or the gas engine to be spinning to run the air conditioning like a normal car does, so it can do that instantaneously as well.
Well, speaking of, and the weather, Tim on Twitter writes, I'd be interested in knowing how the self-driving feature handles in snow and ice. We get just a little bit in this area. Roger, you want to start?
Sure. So right now, the self-driving uses several different keys in the road ahead of it to determine where the lanes are. It does rely pretty heavily on being able to see the line for your lane. And so if the road is covered with snow, the car will not even give you the option to turn on autopilot because it can't see a line. On the other side of your car, it's also using the LiDAR and radar technology to check for the curb. And it does use that as an additional key for saying, this is where I need to position the car. But in the event right now that the car doesn't have enough information to allow autopilot, the autopilot capability can't even be engaged.
Okay. Guys, anything to add there? I mean, any concerns you would have in this region with either electric vehicles, self-driving, et cetera?
Sure. Just related to self-driving, I mean, that's the answer. It's a lot. I mean, obviously, for humans, it's a lot harder to drive in the snow. So, of course, it is for the car itself also. And it's just, right, just don't even give them the option. Just, at least for now, humans got to control it if the roads are covered in snow.
Okay. Let's see here. Back to the phones we go. In Pittsford, Keith is next. Go ahead, Keith.
I have an interesting show. I got a couple of comments and questions. As for self-driving cars, I just can't see it being ever really happening, only due to the problems. If you have one accident because you have one mechanical issue, there'll be lawyers suing it out of existence, such as you had with the three-wheel trikes that Honda used to make. And even lawn jarts. You don't have lawn jarts because people were stupid when they were throwing them. I can see assisted cars like adaptive cruise, lane avoidance and stuff like that, but I just can't ever see a truly autonomous car. And I enjoy driving, but that would be the other reason. The other thing, has anybody ever, other than Germany, which I know, done anything more with pure hydrogen as a combustion? Because essentially there's an endless supply of hydrogen. You take windmills, you distill water at night when they don't need the electricity. You get oxygen and hydrogen, and then you use the hydrogen to burn when you don't have any wind or put it in the car.
Thank you, Keith. Good question. I have no idea. Anybody on the panel now?
Just in reference to hydrogen cars, yeah. I think it's a good alternative, too. It's a great alternative. And it can be useful. It's just, from an engineering standpoint, it's a bit tricky. It's not as, you have to put a lot of energy into water to split it up into hydrogen and oxygen, versus like a lithium-ion battery. You don't waste a lot of energy to charge a lithium-ion battery. A little bit comes out as heat, but for the most part, a large majority, above 90% of the energy you put into a lithium-ion battery stays there, and then you can pull it out to use it in the electric motor. And it's just, it's a bit, efficiency-wise, it's a bit challenging to use hydrogen. And then you have the problem of infrastructure from like a acceptance standpoint. Now you got to ship hydrogen all over the place, just like we do with gasoline. So it's not an insurmountable challenge, but there's work to be done there for sure. Versus electricity, where, I mean, the infrastructure has been around for 50, 60 years to deliver electricity everywhere.
And add there, Jeff?
Yeah, I was just thinking how hydrogen is effectively the same thing as you're doing with the battery. You're just storing the energy in a different location. So when you make hydrogen, you're storing the energy in the hydrogen. And then when you take it back and either burn it in an internal combustion engine or convert it back to electricity, it's effectively the same thing as what your battery is doing. It's just two different competing technologies, and we've yet to see the full scope of what the advantages and disadvantages are of each.
Trying to get through as many of your calls and questions. They're coming in fast now. Richard just says, please ask your guests, is the auto drive similar to other systems that are available, say the Subaru EyeSight system? I don't know that one. Anybody know?
I don't think anyone else is as autonomous as Tesla. I don't know them off the top of my head, but I know that autonomous driving is broken into a couple levels, I think five. I think the Tesla's is the furthest along that. The others are more strictly assisted driving versus autonomous driving, but I don't know how close they all are.
Okay. David in Brighton next up. Go ahead, David.
Evan, I'm curious as to how electric cars are going to pay their fair shared use of the roads. Currently, we look at taxes that are collected on fossil fuels, and that's how the rest of us are paying that, so I'm wondering how that's going to work.
It's a good question, David. Thanks for the phone call. Right now, I don't know if anybody knows exactly the answer. Roger, what do you think?
I don't have an answer. I think it's an important one because maintenance of the roads is critical. And so electric cars are going to have to pay their share as well. Whether that's done by charging a different usage fee for the road for electric cars as opposed to, let's say, internal combustion, because they're already paying the usage fee through the gasoline tax, maybe that's one way to sort of separate the industry a bit and yet still be able to reclaim some of the resource support that you need to be able to maintain this.
You guys, you're probably thinking, that's not our area.
I don't know.
You engineer the systems and government figures out how the tax
exactly.
Works. It's a very interesting question, though, David, and a fair one. Barb in Greece is next up. And Barb, you have a Leaf, is that right?
I do. I've owned my Leaf for 2.5 years now. And I wanted to comment, the earlier caller had asked about internal comfort, you know, the climate control.
Mm-hmm.
And my Leaf, it doesn't have the battery a Tesla does. It gets about a range of about 80 miles. But that depends entirely on whether I'm using heating or cooling inside the car, whether I'm running the wipers, whether I'm using the lights. And those can really cut into range. And I did not understand that when I chose my car. I probably would have bought it anyway. It's very good for what I do, which is a lot of, you know, running errands, running around locally. But, you know, if I need to get from Greece to Pittsford in the winter when I need to run the lights and the wipers, it's really at the edge of what I can do. So that matters.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the phone call, Barb. And, you know, we had a lot of comments about different models, like she's got a Leaf, a Nissan Leaf. John writes to the program and is asking about, do your guests have anything to say about a Nissan Leaf, a Chevy Volt, a Hyundai Ioniq? Just wondering how they're performing. Again, these are not cars I've driven. You guys driven these? Any thoughts on
No, I haven't.
On the market of them? Yeah, we're trying to stick, John, with what we've experienced and what we know, but maybe that sort of cycles into Alex's question, which I had written down somewhere in my pile. Alex was essentially asking, she was asking, what should we expect to pay in the future, whether it's a Tesla or something like these products when it comes to electric, et cetera? Roger, what do you think? What are we going to be paying?
I think competition is a wonderful thing. I think that as the auto industry starts to swing around and focus more and more on the electric vehicle segment, because that segment of the population is growing, we're going to see the prices come down just because of competition. There will be some degree of limitation due to the cost of the technology, but that's always been true in the auto industry anyway. As we introduce new things to cars, initially they're expensive, and then the price comes down because you've got a lot of volume and you can scale things up.
I also should point out, gas prices won't stay where they currently are forever. There will be a time where the price of oil changes and gas prices goes back to that level where no one likes filling up, and then maybe there will be even more emphasis on this. So maybe some final thoughts from our panel. We've been talking about the future of automobiles and all the innovations here. Jeff Botticello, who is the team manager for RIT's electric vehicle team. Some final thoughts from you about where you think the industry's going and maybe even your own role in it.
Sure. Well, I certainly think the electric vehicle industry is headed in the right direction. I just wanted to comment on what you were saying about the competition. I know that Tesla has released a lot of their patents, and personally, I know that's something that definitely helps a lot because you're giving a head start to all the companies who are trying to chase you, and that'll certainly increase competition in the future. I know personally we've looked at some of their patents when we were designing our battery pack for Rev 1, and it was certainly something that helped us a lot with thermal management and things like that. So I think that will definitely increase the productivity of the electric vehicle industry in the future and help us get further.
Okay, Derek?
Yeah. It's exciting. You know, we're definitely right on that edge. And I think autonomous cars specifically, unrelated to electric, but just another technology there, I think it'll definitely be a challenge. You know, there's a lot of laws that got to get passed. As people mentioned, there's a lot of opportunities for lawyers to... to get rich off of companies making mistakes. But I think in the end, it'll definitely revolutionize. It's just going to change the way we use cars, you know. When cars drive themselves, everything changes. You know, parking lots change. You don't necessarily need to park your car and then walk. Why can't your car drop you off, et cetera? I think, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, looking back, we'll see there's a huge change in just our understanding of cars, you know, and how we use them.
Well, Roger, I know you're excited about where it's gone.
Oh, absolutely.
15 seconds. What do you think?
I think the evolution of autopilot into autonomous driving is something that's going to be quite exciting, and it's going to happen very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Again, I mean, I'm a skeptic just like anybody else, but it's starting to feel like I felt about internet on the phone. Which, of course, I famously said, who would want that? I was really right about that. Our thanks to our panel, Roger Duby, Jeff Botticello, Derek Goodheil. Thanks for being here, sharing your expertise.
Our pleasure.
A great listener interaction on the future of the automobile and all kinds of different vehicles. Great job today by Megan Mack, producer. Great field reporting. Really hard assignment for Meg. And Catch Wars. Thank you, Kat. Have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you Tuesday.